You're listening to Queer Writers of Crime, where we feature LGBTQ authors of mystery, suspense, and thriller novels. I'm Brad Shreve, and I interview the authors. Justine is here, and she does the book recommendations. Today, I'm interviewing Joseph R.G. DeMarco. But first, Justine and I have some special guests. So our listeners this week are going to be very happy because they're not going to have to hear about my crush on Paul Rudd. They will have to see how they feel about you not giving a book recommendation.
That's right.
Over the past couple of years, you have given me some recommendations. You listen to a lot more podcasts than I do.
That's right.
Last year, I recommended one to you.
Yes, you did.
What was it?
It was Gayish, and you recommended the rimming episode, so that was quite the introduction.
Yes, I'm sure it was. Well, after this totally improvised conversation, if you look...
Which we've done several times through now.
If you look at your screen, it's a miraculous coincidence that we have Mike Johnson and Kyle Guest, who are the host of Gayish.
Cool. So very cool. It's great to see them.
Hey, it's great to be here.
Thanks for having us.
It's wonderful to have you, gentlemen. Now, I know on your show you usually do some shots while you're doing it.
Shots time? You didn't tell me there was going to be shots.
As Justine knows, it's best to start with rimming and then eventually shots.
Everything's better when you start with rimming.
Oh, good Lord, have mercy.
Well, because we're a book show, we're a little more highbrow, so we use brandy and Never Before Sunset. So go ahead and help yourselves to whatever drinks you want.
Sure.
Just to let our listeners know, Gayish is no small-time podcast out there. They have been featured in Oprah Magazine, Esquire, Queerty. They've been on BuzzFeed. They're a 3-time nominee for Best LGBTQ Podcasts by the People's Choice Podcast Awards, reached number 4 in iTunes sexuality charts, and they have a whole slew of impressive guests. Why they're talking to us, I don't know, but we're happy to have you, and also, happy 4th birthday.
Oh, thank you. Yeah,
thank you so much. We just had our 4th birthday a couple of weekends ago.
Yeah. I mean, I can talk about Paul Rudd. That's fine with me. He just keeps morphing into the sexiest person ever. So, I mean, bearded Paul Rudd is daddy goals.
Oh, God. Yes, I agree 100%. But I'll take him however he comes. Or whenever he comes. Let's start out. What does gayish mean?
What does gayish mean? I think gayish for both Mike and I means that we are both gay, definitively, inexorably gay, for sure, but also don't always feel like we're a part of the community. Sometimes we know things that the community, like, is community knowledge, and sometimes we don't, or we don't like the same things, or we just don't always feel like we belong in the same way that other gays do. And that, we just wanted to talk about that on a show.
Yeah. We like to talk about stereotypes. We pick a different stereotype every week and try to break it down. And at the end of every episode, we talk about the gayest and straightest thing about us in the last week. And all of this to shine a light on the idea that really sexuality is about who you have sex with. And then all of the stuff that's...
Dudes.
Dudes. Yeah, exactly. But not everybody, you know.
Every dude. But, don't speak for me.
Yeah, there's a bunch of stuff in orbit of that that doesn't necessarily apply, and that doesn't make you any less gay. And if you're a straight guy and you do some of these quote unquote gay things, it doesn't make you any less straight. And then the converse for all of that for women and lesbians and non-binary folks, like just
women wearing Converse is pretty lesbian if that's what you're talking about.
But yeah, the idea is you're probably gayish, everybody, whoever you are, regardless of who you bang.
Well, Mike, do your little byline after you two introduce yourselves.
Oh, we're here to bridge the gap between sexuality and actuality.
That's it. Care to elaborate a little more?
Yeah, I mean, we pick all of our episodes are really short phrases, right? Like rimming legit was one of them, but we've covered everything from flowers to dogs to
like hanky code. fisting, sex toys, leprechauns, just kind of anything you can think of. Sometimes stereotypes you'd know about, sometimes stereotypes you wouldn't know about.
Yeah, yeah. It's a it's an hour and a half long format, give or take. We've had shorter episodes, we've had some longer, and we do a little bit of news and cover the topic, and Kyle and I each sort of bring stories and observations and ideas that relate to that topic. And we're a weekly show and have been 221 episodes later, here we are.
Yeah, we each do research on, sometimes it's news stories about the topic, or I often do research studies about the topic to figure out if the stereotype is true or not, or information articles that we read. So we each bring kind of discussion points to our conversation, and we talk about, you know, what we've both learned about the stereotype. And often it's the craziest things that you'll find actually does have some kind of gay angle or stereotype to it. I've never found anything that's turned out to be a dud. Everything is a little bit gay in some way.
Yeah.
Everything's gayish.
Everything's gayish.
So how does Dan fit into your show?
Well, so fucking Dan, that's the nickname
his
that we
official,
gave him.
His official name,
his official
is, fucking
name
Dan.
Is fucking Dan.
Oh, I thought that was his real name. Fucking Dan.
It might as well be now.
In the early days of the show, in the first 100 episodes or so, every time that we would make a mistake, we would get a phone call or an email from fucking Dan. And he's also here in Seattle. So eventually we just said, well, if you're going to be a pain in the ass, just come work for us. And so he does a lot of our research and fact checking, and then does a lot of work for us on social media.
Yeah.
My favorite segment is always the Ma Johnson segment.
Oh, my goodness. Go ahead.
Mike's mom, I was going to just go ahead and take it from you, yeah. So you didn't have. Mike's mom is
batshit crazy.
Okay, sure. Mike, never mind. Mike can go ahead. She is it's amazing because she's so supportive and so down. And a lot of people, when they listen to her, are like, this is incredible that a mom can be that supportive and on board. And she just kind of claims anyone who needs a mom, she's their mom. She's also fucking nuts and overshares way too much. We talk about her vagina way too much that to be appropriate for Mike to hear. And usually we have her on for a segment called Momsplaining with Ma Johnson, where we ask her about a gay thing and she tells us what she thinks it means. And it's usually wrong in a delightful way.
Yeah.
I love it when I hear her call in because, you know, it's going to be crazy.
You know it's going to be crazy.
I think she's the mom of the year. Anybody's mom that is that open and that silly, you got it made.
Yeah, it's really touching, the fan mail that she gets and the things that people say to me about my relationship with her. And it makes you realize how painful the relationship a lot of queer people can have with their parents. And so the idea that she and I can just be the way that we are with each other is sort of inspirational to a lot of gay people. And it's been really humbling and awesome to get to bring, you know, an example of how it can be and show it to the world.
When I first stumbled on your show, it just seemed like it was a comedy banter silly show. And it was funny and I liked it, but I wondered, you know, I don't know how long this will go on. But then when I really listened, your show is a lot deeper than that. I mean, you mentioned some of the silly things like leprechauns, and you also did one on monster trucks. But you also did one on debt, and you've done depression and a lot of other stuff. So in the middle of all that fun time that you guys have, you really get into some heavy topics. And I always learn something.
Oh, wow. Great. Thanks. Hopefully it's you learn true things. That's why we have fucking Dan to correct us. Yeah. I mean, I think it mirrors our friendship and that we have been friends for a very long time. So we do personally talk about deep, important things like mental health, like self-harm, like depression. We talk about those things as friends. And also, in the context of the most serious, heavy things, are people that will laugh and joke about things. So I think it just came naturally for us to kind of have both sides of it. And it may at first seem like it's, you know, just a flippant, like, you know, just jokes, or the fact that you called it comedy is very kind of you, or just lighthearted or what have you. But yeah, we do get into some heavy personal things.
Yeah, we said from the very, very beginning, before episode one, even when we were doing the planning for the show, that authenticity was something that we really wanted to strive for. And gay people are multifaceted. To be a fully authentic gay person means having struggles with mental health and substance abuse and sexual assault. And like it means more than just RuPaul and iced coffee. Like there's a lot to it. And we want to show all aspects of it, warts and all.
Justine, do you have a favorite episode?
Oh, man. You didn't tell me we were going to go here. You didn't send me the questions in advance.
I told you we were going to wing
it. My favorite segment was Maude Johnson. That's what I was leading with, man.
That's a good one.
I got to tell you what my favorite was, which in the interest of science, Mike, you took it upon yourself to go to a jerk-off club in Seattle.
Yes, sir. Yep.
I was shocked because I never knew such a thing existed. We don't have one in LA. I looked it up after your show.
Oh, good Lord.
Really?
It was really interesting that you shared that experience and you gave it, for lack of a better word, dignity. You didn't make fun of it. You
said no, none of our listeners ever.
Yeah. I mean, I
appreciate that.
I mean, you had fun like you always do, but I don't think it was at the expense of anybody that goes there.
Right, right. Yeah, we try to be respectful. So we don't always necessarily, 100% of the time succeed, but we try not to kink shame or yuck anybody's yum is the phrase. And it's also true that the show has led me to really confront a lot of things that I might not otherwise. And Kyle likes to make fun of me a little bit for it. Like, if there's something that I might have been afraid to try on my own, but if I can say I'm going to do it for Gayish because it fits this episode that we have planned, I've had some really great experiences and learned a bunch of stuff about myself because I had the show as an excuse to go try it. And, it's been a growth opportunity for me. Thank you, Kyle.
Yeah, that's the only reason we're doing this, so you can jerk off a bunch.
Yeah.
Well, my opinion is you apologize way too much.
Oh. Oh, sorry about that.
Sorry about that.
You know, you cover something and you offend some people and you're always very quick to apologize. Not always. Huh. Sometimes you'll state why you won't apologize, but a lot of times you do. And you just need to roll with it and ignore those folks. That is my opinion. You've been around a lot longer than I have. But.
Well, I mean, I think that we want to, again, be authentic. Like, at no point are we going to take audience feedback and I think, like, fundamentally change the show or who we are as a result of that. But definitely want to acknowledge to people, we heard you, right? And it's a fine line to walk sometimes, I think. But we do our best and it seems to be working, I guess.
It works for me.
It works for me, too.
Justine, you sent me a message saying you had something specific you wanted to talk about.
Well, I would like to know, since we're skipping my book recommendations, maybe we can get Mike and Kyle's book recommendations.
Yeah, absolutely. I recently finished The Deviant's War by Eric Cervini, and it is it's nonfiction. And covers the story of the parts of the gay rights movement starting in the 1950s with a man named Frank Kameny and his struggles to get reinstated as a federal employee after being ousted for gay activity that he was caught in a San Francisco bathroom for. And it's really a really interesting look at a super critical time in our history, pre-Stonewall. And I really liked it. I think it's good reading, and also the author is very hot.
Which of course is a factor in while you're reading a book. Mine is one that I just read recently because Mike clued me into The Black Flamingo by Dean Atta. It is a fiction, but you can tell it's very close to home for the author. It's written in a style that is a bit of poetry and like almost lyrical poetry in its narrative and also poetry-esque about a kid who's mixed race, black and gay and trying to find his place. And it's after I read it, became my favorite book now. It's incredible.
Mm. Wow.
Is there a hot guy that wrote that?
I have not looked him up. I, like Mike, am intellectual instead of physical, so so I didn't base my opinion on whether he's hot or not.
Well, based on what Mike said, I am going to find a really sexy model and put him on my book jackets from now on.
Right?
Good plan.
Honestly, I think that's one of the shitty but true things about gay culture. You put a hot guy on it and it's going to do, you know, 50% better than if you don't.
Yep. Absolutely. Yep.
Which is why Mike and I like are not popular, because we don't have abs. So, like, I don't know.
How about fucking Dan? Does he have abs?
No.
No, I don't think so.
None of us have abs. No. Another unattainable goal.
No, neither maybe. Brad nor I have abs either. So
I know, right?
Well, I have them, but nobody can see them.
Yeah. They're somewhere.
Yeah.
What are your favorite episodes, guys?
You know, it was an early episode. I forget what number, 30 or less, but weddings. I keep coming back to weddings. So some dear friends of ours got married, and we were involved in it, and just we took a different approach than most of our episodes, and Kyle and I recorded separately on a handheld recorder that we had at the wedding, and then spliced it together. Kyle did a fantastic job with the editing and creating a narrative out of our two individual tracks, and we cover a lot of really, I think, deep emotional issues, all in the context of this really joyous occasion. And it made for a really great episode that keeps coming back to my mind over and over.
One of my favorites, also an earlier one, is about consent. And it is, Mike shares a super personal story about kind of that being gay and that line, that the danger you can face when being in hookups and what the boundary of consent is. And I think it's, it was deep and heavy and emotional, but also relatable, and things that gay people, some of these aspects like hookup and the danger involved in that, or the risk involved in being gay or meeting a stranger, like there are things that we maybe talk about with our friends, but don't always talk about these genuine experiences. So I was very impressed with Mike for sharing his experience in there.
I'm very impressive.
Well, impressive episodes is when shortly after lockdown, you guys got together and Kyle was not doing very well, and you guys just talked it through on the show. And it really resonated with me and a lot of the other experiences of people I knew.
Thank you. Yeah, Mike is the reason I have been able to open up more, like not just on the show, but just as a person. He has encouraged me to be able to share things because he's non-judgmental, he's open, he's genuine, he's honest, and I think that's reflected on the show. And that was one of those times where I usually wouldn't share that kind of thing with people, but I was just like, I can't do a show right now, so instead we just recorded our conversation. And I think it was technically we were breaking the lockdown because you weren't supposed to, and I was just like, I have to, for my mental health, to like keep existing as a human, I need to see someone and talk about this.
Yeah. It's been a weird year.
Yeah, it has been. And you guys are really raw, and take that word for whatever you want to say. But I'm saying raw I'll take in it. The sense that you bare your soul, and it's very refreshing, and you can tell it's real.
Yeah, thank you. And it's one of our fundamental values. And when we have our production meetings and we're planning out our episode schedule, quite often an idea will come up and one of us will make the face that says, oh, that makes me real uncomfortable. And then we almost always take that episode on as soon as we can, because we know there's something there that we need to talk about.
I could go on and on, but I have an interview coming up. I want to thank you guys for stopping in and saying hello.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
For listeners, it's Gayish, and I'll have the link in the show notes, or wherever you're listening to this show, you can find them as well. They're pretty much everywhere.
We're pretty much everywhere. Mm-hmm. Just like a bad case of gonorrhea.
Well said.
Thanks for coming, guys. We really appreciate it.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having us.
Hi, this is Brad. Not only do I interview authors, I write novels too. Check out my Mitchell Riley mystery series on my website, bradshreve.com. My guest is Philadelphia native Joseph R.G. DeMarco. He is the author of the Marco Fontana Mysteries. He also writes the Vampire Inquisitor series. His plays have been produced in Philadelphia, New York, and elsewhere. His works appear in the International Encyclopedia of Marriage and Family, in the Encyclopedia of Men and Masculinities, and the Journal of Homosexuality. He was a columnist for The Advocate, In Touch, and X Factor magazine. He was the editor-in-chief of the Weekly Gazette in Philadelphia and the national magazine New Gay Life. Currently, he is editor-in-chief of the online magazine Mysterical E. And to make it clear, he also writes books. That's a lot.
It is.
Well, welcome to Queer Writers of Crime, Joe.
Thank you. Well, I'm glad to be here.
Well, you have been a busy man over the years, so I want to start with your background because it's pretty overwhelming to me. I didn't even read all of it. How did your writing journey begin?
Oh, goodness. I've always wanted to write since I was a little kid, and I'm sure everybody says that, but it's true. And when I came out, I discovered the gay press and gay media, and so I just naturally gravitated to that, writing articles and covering things in Philadelphia. So it started that way. But I always wanted to do fiction. And I guess I never had enough courage to do it and stuck to the nonfiction until I could feel good enough to do the fiction that I really wanted to do.
When you started, was it as a journalist?
It was as a journalist first. And then I began to do more kinds of feature articles, which required research and stuff like that, and more in-depth interviews.
How did you get started in journalism?
It was the gay press. Everything was wide open, so I just did it. It was not, no training, no nothing, just... And I'm sure it's the same today in some respects,
It's a shame many of those magazines are gone.
Everything, yeah.
Frontiers was the big one in the LA area, and they're
right,
gone.
Some
of them have gone online, but there's just not as many as there used to be.
And it's not exactly the same either online. It's there's something about a print issue.
And they don't have the, quote, massage fads in the back of the magazine.
No. Yes, all that's gone. That's really a shame because they were, whether you used it or not, they were fun to read.
Yes, they were. That they were. Well, I think they have websites specifically just for that now, so the magazines don't have to be there. Now, your most recent mystery, The Vermilion Pursuit, was published in December of 2020, a few months ago. It's the Marco Fontana Mystery Series, book number 5, correct?
5, right, yes.
Who is Marco?
Marco is also a Philadelphia native, an Italian guy in his... At the time of that novel, in his early 30s, grew up in the city, joined the police force, but after a while was kind of hounded out of it. He's not good with authority. And in casting about what to do, one of the things he decided to do was to start a male strip troupe, which he continues to run, as well as his private investigation business.
Well, that's interesting.
Just slip that in there.
And most PIs are not good with authority.
No, that's true. That's why they're PIs.
So did he get into the strip club business or did he become a PI first?
I think he was doing the strip club stuff first and then gravitated to doing the PI business. Although he had been doing, in the third book in the series, Crimes on Latimer, that is a group of 6 long short stories of cases that didn't become a whole book. And the first one actually takes place when he was in high school. So he'd been toying with this private investigation stuff for a long time.
Well, it's an interesting combination. And I generally don't ask where your ideas come from because that's such a difficult question to ask. But this one being so unusual, how did you come up with that connection?
Owning the strip troupe? Well, I had been doing...
Doing the 2 jobs at the same time.
Those 2 jobs at the same time. I don't know. I just thought it would be fun to... Something to balance out the daytime work as a PI and he'd go to the bar where his troop is based and do that at night, keep him busy the whole day. And it's kind of fun. I mean, I told you that I did a very long study of male strippers in different cities, and it always kind of seemed like fun to me to run something like that. So it was kind of natural for me to want my PI to do something like that in addition to his PI work. Nothing pays the bills entirely, so.
I'm always jealous of strippers because I wish I'd had that body. The fifth novel, The Vermilion Pursuit, that I just mentioned earlier. Tell us that story.
Well, it takes a direction that I have been increasingly interested in doing. It gets into the art world, and I think that there's going to be a few more with that kind of a background to them. Uncle comes to town and is chairing a panel that's trying to decide whether a Botticelli that they have is an actual Botticelli or not a fake, but not a genuine, maybe done by a student of Botticelli. And in the course of events, one of the other panel members is murdered, who had also been a pretty heavy rival of his uncle. And of course, his uncle discovers the body, and Marco needs to find out who actually did the crime.
And art is one of your passions.
Yes, it is. It's something I've always loved and have always had people in my life who are actual artists. Something that you envy a stripper's body. I envy being able to draw and paint and all of that. My drawings come, people are like stick figures rather than.
I was a pretty good artist when I was a lot younger, but I don't have that skill anymore. I never honed that skill as much as I should have or wanted to. I guess I didn't want to at the time. Now I wish I did.
Yeah, well, you still could. It's never too late, as they say.
That is true. That is true.
Especially in art, you can always sit down and do it and hone your skills as you go along. It just, to me, seems like something very serene and peaceful to do. I know it's not, but it seems like that from the outside.
Well, a lot of the great authors started in a later age.
Mm-hmm. That's true, yeah.
The first Marco Fontana mystery was written 11 years ago. How much time has passed in Marco's life?
Oh, that's a wonderful question. I don't know. a couple of years, not as many as the novels have been out. It's just two or three or four, perhaps, but not as many as 11. And 2020 will never appear in the series.
There's been a lot of debate amongst authors whether to include 2020 or not.
For me, it's I don't want to talk about it. I don't want to hear about it. I don't want to read about it. And I won't write about it. It's just not going to have happened. I'm very bitter about the whole deal. It ruined lots of things for a lot of people. And it's for me, I became just very angry about it all. So I'd rather just put it aside and not deal with it.
I've heard the argument that it should be written in there, just like it would have been inappropriate during the 80s to not write about the AIDS crisis. I disagree. I'm like you. I'm going to skip right over 2020. I've had enough of it.
Yeah. Well, that's why it's kind of the novels are kind of timeless. I don't put a year to them. I don't, I mean, in one, I know there's a mayoral election or a Senate election, but I don't put a year to it. So it doesn't really matter. These things could have happened anytime. They're in the 21st century, but not a particular year.
So you keep that kind of open.
So I don't feel that I have to deal with 2020. I'm not doing it sequentially by year anyway. So...
Well, that's kind of nice because it lets the reader paint their own picture.
Right.
How has Marco changed over the series of the five books?
Well, I think he's grown in his skill. He's grown in his approach to being to investigatory work. He's also, at least in the Vermilion Pursuit, he's beginning to think a little bit more about his personal romantic life. I don't mean there's going to be a romance element, but he's kind of commitment challenged. I forget, one reviewer was not against that, but other people have been wondering why he doesn't settle down and get involved with, you know, and he's not that kind of guy, but he is thinking about it. And in fact, in conversations he had with his uncle in the Vermilion Pursuit, his uncle really made him think about this kind of stuff. And in the next novel, which I'm working on now, I think he's going to deal with it a little bit more. Whether or not he's going to actually have a relationship, I don't know. He's been in sort of dating relationships, but nothing more serious than that. But he's beginning to think about it.
Well, that romance aspect, I don't want to get into it too much because I talk about it too much on the show, but a lot of readers expect that.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I have more of there's the Doyle and Cord series that I do, which is a pair of cops who left the force and started a PI agency. That's more, it's not a romance novel, but it deals with their relationship as a major part of the series. So right now they're on the skids waiting to do the next novel.
Well, you mentioned that you have another Marco book coming.
Mm-hmm.
When can we expect that?
I'm hoping before the end of the year. It takes a while for me to... Actually, I had it all planned, and I'd even started writing it even before the pandemic hit. But I wanted to finish the Vermilion Pursuit first. And this one is going to take place in Florida. So it's adding another layer of research that I have to do to make sure I get some things right, at least most things. So I'm hoping by the end of the year.
Has the past year made it difficult to write?
Yes. I mean, I did. I finished The Vermilion Pursuit, and I finished A Battle in Blood, which came out just last month, I think it was. It's the second in the Vampire series. I finished both of those and got them out, but it took a lot longer than it would have normally. I couldn't, focus and concentration were out the window. And that's another, you know, thing that just makes you angry.
Yeah, I've heard that a lot, and I've been part of that. I expected to have a book out before now, and it was so difficult last year. And a lot of people said, you know, oh, I thought I'd have so much more time. You know, I'm stuck at home. I'll be able to knock a bunch of books out. And
right.
No, you got to be in the right space.
That's right. Exactly right. Yeah.
It was really hard to be in the right space for pretty much everything last year.
Yes, I agree. And which is another reason I don't want to hear about it after it's over. It's.
Well, you were saying that the next book is going to take place in Florida and you're going to need to do some research. In your books, I know you've delved into the Catholic Church, the lives of strippers, as you said, the leather community, organized crime. How much time do you spend research on your novels?
More than I like, because, I mean, but research is fun for me. I'm trained as a librarian, and so doing research, finding sources, you know, finding how to ask a question is, for me, a lot of fun, which is unfortunate because research can really be a time suck. So you have to, you know, you have to limit yourself. But I also find that I do research all along the way, even when I finish, quote unquote, and get on with the writing, I still do some more as I'm writing. And sometimes that also affects the direction of the story. You learn something and you think, oh, I've got to do this or I've got to change that. So I do a lot, but it's, to me, it's fun.
So. Now let's get more specific regarding your research.
Mm-hmm.
You brought up in your bio that you sent me the research that you did on strippers.
Right.
Which certainly got my interest. Tell us that story, because you were really in depth with that one.
Right. Well, for some, I just had this fascination. I went to, with two friends, one of whom was my late partner, to a place in New York called The Gaiety, which features in one of Madonna's old videos. And it was a strip club on Times Square, or right off Times Square, which was unbelievably nice. I mean, just, you know, you sat there. It was like a theater setting, like almost like a porn theater, except that it had a stage in the front. And they'd have a whole bunch of guys. And these were hot guys who did amazing routines. There was, and this is a tiny, you know, not a huge place, not a high ceiling. There was one guy who was actually tossing batons on fire in his act. It was something to see.
Not just moving and shaking.
Not just moving. No, no. And they all were, it was really, it was interesting. And so it just, I was fascinated with why people are doing this, how they get themselves to do this. Because it is, there is a moving and shaking and bearing yourself in a lot of ways to an audience of mostly strangers. And so I decided, my late partner was a sociologist, and I'd learned a lot about doing sociological research. So I thought, I'm going to do something, you know, as an independent researcher, and started by, there was a strip club here in Philadelphia, and I thought, okay, I'm going to get to know the people, I'm going to get to know the owners, and I'm going to ask if I can do some interviews with their people. And they were all thrilled to do that. So it was a lot of fun. I just started doing these in-depth interviews on tape with them and about their lives and their work and all of that. And from there, I just went to other cities, New York, Montreal, D.C., Chicago, all of which had, D.C. had a really interesting situation. In almost everywhere in the U.S., you cannot have alcohol and nudity in the same room at the same time. Mm-hmm. But in D.C., you could. Rules were different there. Politicians get what they want, I guess. You could have nudity and alcohol and whatever else going on at the same time in the same place. So that was a whole, that's all gone now. It was knocked down to put up the convention center. I'm not even sure they have a strip club anymore. And the rules are, I mean, in Canada, it's different too. You can have alcohol and nudity. It doesn't matter. Nobody's going to get out of control, you know, because of that. I don't even know what the basis of that rule is. So I did this study for several years. In the middle of it all, my partner died, and that sort of derailed me for a while. And then I got back into, you know, working with the material that I had and produced a few articles and had hoped to do a longer work. And so, but I will get back to it and do that. But that's basically the story.
It's interesting to me that you focused on DC because I went and visited a friend there, and mm-hmm. while she was at work during the day, I went and toured all the monuments almost mm-hmm. every day. But there was one there was one day that I did go to. It's my very first gay strip club I had ever mm-hmm. been to.
Which one was?
I can't remember the name. I wish
but
I
it was in this kind of warehouse-looking district.
Well, I can tell you that there was a – it was an adult store in the front, and okay. then in the back – there
oh,
was,
yes.
Or behind the,
I know.
Behind the storefront, there was the stripper, and behind that was the play area.
The play area. Yes, I think I know the place you mean.
Okay. It was quite an experience for this young lad. And you interviewed how many strippers? The number you gave me was astronomical.
Around 200. Yeah. I mean, they weren't all in-depth. There were quite a number in-depth, but others were just conversations where I took notes. I didn't get to tape all of them. But you get a piece of information from everybody. Every interview is a little bit different. Every interview gave you a little bit different look at things. But there was also a lot of similarities in them. So it amounted to around that number, maybe a little more. I don't know. I didn't keep an exact tally of the number of people. But I have all of my closet is bursting with notes. So,
well, I'm guessing in your research, it's not hard to get people to talk. People love to talk about themselves.
They do. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, some are a little suspicious, you know, they wonder what you're doing. But on the whole, yeah, they were happy to talk about them, about themselves and their work and why they got into it. And like, a number of them were actually straight, just doing, I mean, they're all just doing it for the money. It's not, they, you know, I mean, they, a number of them enjoyed doing it, you know, as the type of work they were doing, but the money is the big thing.
I would guess, and you can tell me, is there a good number that are putting themselves through college that way?
A number of them are doing that or just paying other bills. You know, there were a couple that were, one at least was a PhD student who was doing it. So yeah, they have a variety of reasons, but, and you can, it's also, you can make a lot of money. Mm-hmm. Those G strings filled with dollar bills mounts up to a lot of money.
It may not be much material, but you can get a lot of money stuffed in those.
You can get a lot of money, yes. And it's not always just $1 bills either. So, you know.
Yeah. A girl I went to high school with went to college in Atlanta and went to work at one of the real popular strip clubs there, which amazed me because it didn't seem to fit her personality. But mm-hmm. she paid her way through college with no problem whatsoever.
Yeah, no. It's, it's work.
Well, yeah, I would think so. Out of all your research, not necessarily just the stripper research, but mm-hmm. all that you've done, what have you found the most interesting that stands out?
Of things that I've researched?
Yes.
Okay, so we won't count the strippers because to me they're very interesting.
Yeah, and we covered them.
Yes, but other than that, history, I think, and art history, all of that is mixed up in my mind. I really enjoy doing that. Reading about different historical periods, and I also like to read alternate history because it's kind of, if you know the period that he wrote an alternate history about, it becomes a lot of fun to read that. So, but yeah, I think history, art, those are my favorite things to do research in.
Alternate history interests me. What do you know what drives you towards that?
I guess maybe we all have a desire to know what would it be like if things were different, if things had happened differently, you know, if Trotsky had been killed in a train wreck, would he have, not Trotsky, Lenin, would that whole Russian thing turned out differently, or I don't know. So I think it's just a desire to know what else might have happened.
I don't remember if it was a book or a movie, and you may be familiar with it. It was a time travel story where a guy kept going back to stop the assassination of Kennedy. Mm-hmm. And every time he would change things and go back into his own time, things were worse.
Worse. Yeah, you don't know what the consequences will be. That's the whole thing. And that's what's brilliant about some of the people who write it. If they really do a good job, and one of the ones who does a pretty good job is Harry Turtledove. I think that's how he pronounces his name. If they know their history, then they'll know what the consequences might be, or they can at least make a good case for that. So that's fascinating. But I just like history in general.
Do you like Michener novels where fiction and history are intertwined?
Yes. Yeah, I like that. It's a lot of fun. Hopefully one day I'll do one, a standalone maybe on that in that way. But that takes even more research because readers are pretty good at spotting what's good and what's not good. So,
yeah, you've really got to do your research and know what you're talking about.
Right.
What have you found that was the most difficult thing to research?
I don't know. I think every time I do research for any of the novels, there's always something that I come up against a brick wall. It's some little thing that I can't find an answer to, but nothing stands out in my memory of being the most difficult. I think, it actually was all easy to find a whole lot of stuff. Like in the murder on Camac has to do with the death of John Paul I, the Pope in the 1970s, who died after only a little more than a month. And there's always been conspiracy theories spinning about that. And so finding out about that and some of the history behind these things was easier than I thought it would be. Of course, you never know who's telling the truth and who's not, but it was still easy to gather tons of information and work with it. So, and it was fun. And after a few years later, my mother passed away, and I got several boxes of stuff that from her house. You know, my sister doled out all of this stuff, and I found in one of those boxes a huge pile of clippings that I guess I had made at the time about the death of that pope. So it was something that I guess stuck in my memory all those years.
Well, when you said the next Marco Fontana novel is going to be in Florida, it jumped out at me because I noticed in his novels and then your vampire novels, and I don't know about the others, they all take place in Philadelphia, your hometown.
Right.
You are very passionate about your city.
Well, yeah, I guess. And I guess that's a... I have a love-hate relationship with the city. It's got its good points, but it has a lot more bad points than it should have. And it's a failure of leadership. You know, we had a couple of good mayors who did wonderful things, and we've had a spate of bad mayors who don't know what to do with themselves and or the city. And but I do. It's the only World Heritage City in North America, which we were awarded a couple of years ago. And rightfully so. I mean, there's a lot of really good stuff here, but it needs to be treated better, and there needs to be more creative thinking about things that go on in the city. Right now, we're just coming out of this pandemic lockdown, and things are coming back to life, which is nice to see. But it was really disheartening, especially in the first months, to walk around and see that it was kind of like an apocalyptic scene, you know. It was, and I'm sure many big cities were the same way.
Yeah, you mentioned the love-hate relationship with Philadelphia. I live in Los Angeles, and I absolutely love living here, and I can't wait to move away.
I feel the same way about Philadelphia. Yes.
It's definitely, it's fun for now, but it's not where I'm going to call home.
Yeah,
forever. Well, I actually bring that up with all your travels that you've done. If you did win the lottery, where would you go? Because you've done a lot of traveling around the world.
If I won enough of the lottery, if I won a big enough sum, I'd probably go to Europe. If I didn't win that much, I'd go to Fort Lauderdale. That's where I'd move. I love that city. I go there just about every year, and although with the 2020 exception.
My daughter went to college in England and is now getting her graduate degree in Germany. But she's traveled extensively throughout Europe, and she pretty much let it be known that she's not coming back.
Good for her.
She doesn't know where she's going to settle, but it's not going to be here in the States.
Yeah. I mean, Italy would be wonderful. Vienna would be a big choice. It's consistently voted the most livable city in the world every year. So I don't know, but that's one direction I would go. I've been to China. That's wonderful. But at the moment, I'm not sure I'd to live there. But it's a beautiful place, though. I was totally fascinated.
Going back to Philadelphia, you live in a neighborhood called the Gayborhood.
Right.
Which most cities, larger cities, have or had a gay area, such as the Castro in San Francisco.
Right.
Do you still have an active gay community?
We have an active gay community, but the Gayborhood has kind of shrunken now. It tried to sort of expand. And I'm not going to say it's the pandemic's fault, although a couple of places did falter. One, the only lesbian bar we had closed. I was hoping they'd survive, but they didn't. I'm hoping another one will open up because there is no other one. It's really a shame. I'm trying to think. I think that's the only gay bar that closed after due to this, but it's still, there's a lot of new building going on. I don't know where the people are coming from who are going to live here, but they're building more condos and apartments than you would imagine you'd need. There are a lot of people who live here and work in New York. And so that's one of the groups that's, you know, filling out the city. But that's kind of cutting into some corporation just bought and knocked down a building which had a gym, which was hugely popular with the gay community. That's gone. So I don't know. I think it's going to take a while. There's an initiative amongst some people to start pouring some money into the gayborhood and getting some more new places to open up. So we'll see what happens. But it's always ebbed and flowed. The gayborhood has moved from one part of the city to this part where it is now. It used to be not far from here, but it was a totally different set of bars and things. So I always have hope that these things will change. I'm a cynical person, but I'm not a pessimist. I don't know if that makes sense, but that's what I'm like. So.
Well, we've lost a lot of gay bars over the past year in Los Angeles, and one of them was a dance club that was my husband and I. It was our favorite dance club, and it's really sad to see that happening. And the reason I asked if it was an active community, in San Francisco, the Castro and West Hollywood here in L.A., still large gay communities, but there's been so much gentrification that it's going away.
Yeah.
Are you seeing the same thing in Philadelphia?
Same thing here, yes. Yeah, I mean, gay people live all throughout the city now and not concentrated in one area. But, and we didn't have as many bars. I mean, we're a big city. We used to be the third largest city in the country. Now I think we're number six, which is still pretty big. Mm-hmm. But we don't have the number of bars you would think a city this size should have. So that's always been a sore point with me, but, you know, not a bar owner type. So I'm not going to go out and start a business. But I just think the community here deserves more in the way of places to meet. And I think there's a lot of things that mitigate against that. The internet, the younger generations not thinking it's necessarily needed. They'll discover that it is at some point. But yeah. That's happened too, the whole gentrification thing. That's what happens with the gym I just said. They've been knocked down. They're going to be building all kinds of apartments there. And I can only hope that a lot of gay people will move into it. I don't know.
See? Yeah, the Fault Line, which has been an icon in L.A., is being torn down for a marijuana distributor and a holistic health store. So quite a change. Though I do remember before, back when it was illegal, there was still a lot of pot smoking going on there.
I'm sure.
Now it's legal. I owe you an apology. I promised you an article for Mysterical E a long time ago.
Oh, that's right.
I haven't fulfilled that. You are the editor-in-chief for the Mysterical E. What is the Mysterical E?
It's an online mystery magazine. It's actually been going since the 1990s, which is quite a long time for these things. And it started out, I don't know exactly how it started out. I just know the people who were involved. And what they did was kind of a rolling, they'd every once in a while come out, I don't want to call it a new issue, but with a new set of stories appended to the old set of stories that they had. So it was a huge, long list of stories, but there was no sort of schedule. And with the pandemic, there hasn't been as much of a schedule as there should have been. But now we do it quarterly, and we do mystery stories of all sorts. I have some features about writing and other spotlighting different mysteries and things like that. And we do excerpts from novels. We do all kinds of stuff like that. So we've been around a long time. I got involved in 2004. The first issue I put out was 2005.
Oh, so that was back in its early stages.
Yeah, it was after whoever owned it before, they were giving it up at some point. And I thought, oh, this is great. I'll rescue it and we'll do it. And so my very best friend is a whiz with computer stuff, and he redesigned the whole thing, and it looks beautiful now.
I will agree it does, but one thing I found really interesting is that online magazine has been around, as you said, for over 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't see any ads.
No, we don't do any ads. It's all out of my pocket. It's really just paying for that. We don't pay people to publish anything. And I just pay for the you know, upkeep fees, the host web hosting service, stuff like that, which doesn't amount to a whole lot. But it's an important, I've had writers who've been noticed by agents in this thing. One who's I see his name on Facebook all the time, advertisements for his books. So we've been noted in the best mysteries of whatever year. So, you know, people look at it, and I like being able to give people a chance to sometimes get their first publication or whatever. So it's fun. But it's also, it lives and dies by my schedule. If I can't get an issue out on time, it'll get out, but when I can do it.
And I noticed, I don't believe it's just strictly for LGBTQ.
No, it's mystery in general. I'd like to have more gay content, but you know, it's, I've asked people, I've put out notices. I may do it again, but I don't know where to advertise for this, but yeah, I'd like to have more LGBTQ content, but it's just dependent upon who sends us material.
We have reached the time for awkward questions authors get.
Okay.
Which you knew was coming since you're
a regular listener.
Having surveyed dozens of authors, I'm going to spin the wheel and we're going to see what question you get. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay, this is actually probably a pretty good question, I think.
Okay.
How much or how little is your main character like you?
Ah, well, that's funny because that's a question that a couple of people have asked in an accusatory way. Your main character is really you, isn't he? Mm-hmm. Well, no, not really. I mean, yes, we're both Italian and we both live in Philadelphia, but he has a much more exciting life than I do. And I guess, I don't know, he's like me in a lot of ways, but he's not like me in a lot of ways too. And he would do things that I probably wouldn't do. Or I would be, you know, a little bit taken aback at doing. But yeah, I mean, his Italian background comes from me. But I don't think of him as me when I'm writing. I think he's his own person. And I'm sure he doesn't think of him as me either.
I would guess it's almost impossible to write and not have a bit of yourself in your characters. I could be wrong.
And I think there's a bit of yourself in almost every character that you write. I don't what that might be. I don't know, but I think a lot of it is unconscious, so you can't really think about, oh, I'm doing this because I would do this. No, they all become characters in their own right, and so they do what they want to do, and that's good. It doesn't bother me. I want that to happen, and it makes for more interesting, you know. Except when I have him beaten up or tossed out onto a highway or shot at or even shot. But those are things he's not happy about, but makes for a good story.
Well, it's funny. That question is the one that came up. I was on another podcast being interviewed last week or 1 or 2 weeks ago, and I was asked that question, is your main character you? And I give basically, there's a lot of me in him. But it's not entirely me. The cynical side is me. And what I like to say is he gets to spew his cynicism where I can't. Otherwise, nobody would want to be around me.
Right. Well, I know Marco gets his wandering eye from me. That's for sure. But he actually he gets to actualize it more than I do. But yeah, there's a little of me in him. But there's a lot of him in himself.
It's amazing how fast 45 minutes goes.
Yes, I'm shocked. it feels like I just sat down here.
Yeah. A reminder to our listeners, my guest is Joseph R.G. DeMarco.
Right.
And you write the Marco Fontana Mysteries and More. And your most recent novels is The Mystery of the Vermilion Pursuit and also A Battle in Blood, which is your Vampire Inquisitor series.
Right.
Thank you very much for being on the show,
Shay. Thank you for having me. Thank you. It was a good experience.
Be sure to subscribe to Queer Writers of Crime wherever you hear our show. Tell a friend, too. Thank you for listening.